tape dans sa tête loin de la vision réelle d'un humain. C'est fait du quotidien, mais est-ce la pensée du spectateur? Mais ici il devient comme une victime de malins spectateurs. La veille vierge font-ils se tache de noir, absorbe la violence à l'instar d'un boulevard. Flingue, viol et pulsion pour la création de vrais cauchemars de dimension. Hollywood dans l'état de choc et paniqué, braqué, bavé, caractère, caractère.
Hi, this is Bonnie Rogues of Third World, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, Canada, that is, for those of you who don't know. Eh? What a world. Whoa, 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 yee!
Today on Wings. December 1st, 2023 was the 35th annual World AIDS Day. The UN's chosen theme for that day and the whole year ahead is Let Communities Lead. Wings Kenya correspondent Diana Wanyonyi has visited a community that is taking the lead. They help children who are infected with HIV virus to lead safe, proud, and productive lives.
Hamjambo watoto wangu.
Hamjambo.
Naishi na virusi.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Here's Diana Wanyonyi reporting from Kenya.
Statistics from UNICEF on global and regional trends updated in July 2023 indicates that of the estimated 39 million people living with HIV worldwide in 2022, 2.58 million were children aged between 0 to 19. It continues to say that each day in 2022, approximately 740 children became infected with HIV and approximately 274 children died from AIDS-related causes, mostly because of inadequate access to HIV prevention, care, and treatment services. In Kenya, the Kenya AIDS Indicator Survey shows that 0.9% of children between 18 months to 14 years have been infected with HIV virus. The figure comes to around 104,000 children who have been infected with HIV virus in Kenya. It's Sunday afternoon. Entering the Mariakani Sub-County Hospital in Kilifi County on the Kenyan coast. The hospital is 39 kilometers from Mombasa town. I'm seeing a lot of people. Some are seated on their wooden bench waiting to be treated. Others have come to check on their sick loved ones, and some are medics, health practitioners, and cleaners. This hospital serves as a meeting point for children between 1 to 15 years old of age who are HIV positive. These children visit this place once a week to educate and encourage each other.
Hamjambo watoto wangu.
Hamjambo.
Naishi na virusi. Natumia dawa zangu wakati ninavofaa. Watoto wangu nawaambia mkule dawa vizuri na muishi vizuri. Hutakufa kwa ajili ya virusi. Kila Jumapili ni njoni kwenye support group. Mariakani, tujijihamishe na mafunzo.
Hello, my fellow children. I am living with HIV. I use my medication at the right time. My fellow children, take medication as directed and live well because you will not die because of the virus. Come to this support group. In Mariakani, we educate each other. Tumaini support group has 39 children in total who are all HIV positive. They use songs and poems that have HIV and AIDS message to educate each other on prevention and living positively with the virus.
Ukiugonjwa mbaya wamaliza wanadamu ni kwa nini unanyonya watu damu unatesa ulimwengu kusiadi magharibi unaua kwa uchungu wazazi hata mabwana ndugu nawaelezea jiadharini na ukimwi msione ni maisha yenu ya mwisho.
Tumaini is a Swahili word that means hope. This is a group that was formed by these children to support each other emotionally, and it's also a safe place for them to speak up on their HIV status openly. Some of the children were infected with the virus during breastfeeding from the infected mothers, while others contracted the virus after being defiled by people who were HIV positive. Statistics from UNICEF on global and regional trends indicates that as of 2022, roughly 13.9 million children under the age of 18 had lost one or both parents to HIV-related causes. Millions more have been affected by the epidemic through a heightened risk of poverty, homelessness, school dropout, discrimination, and loss of opportunities, as well as COVID-19. These hardships include prolonged illness and death. Though these children look and sound happy, they face a lot of stigma from their communities. Anita is an orphan who was born with HIV.
Jambo watoto wenzangu.
Jambo.
Niko darasa la pili. Mimi ni mmoja wale ambao anaishi na virusi. Virusi vinavyosababisha ukimwi. Wazazi mweze mkatoa watoto wenu waje wapimwe. Wajue hali zao na msiwafiche. Na tupunguze maambukizi. Nawahimiza watoto wenzangu, mmeze madawa wakati mnafaa. Msiache kumeza madawa na msikose lishe.
Hello my fellow children. I'm in grade 2. I am HIV positive. I am urging parents to take their children for testing HIV and AIDS and don't hide them. This will reduce infecting other people. I'm urging you, my fellow children, to take your antiretroviral drugs at the right time and do not skip your meals. Anita introduces me to her close friend.
Watoto wenzangu amjambo.
Amjambo.
Nyote mnatumia madawa?
Ndio.
Nawahimiza kwamba kuishi na virusi sio mwisho wa maisha. Na ndio mwanzo wa maisha. Asante.
Hello my fellow children. Are you all taking your drugs on time? I am advising you that living with HIV is not the end of the life. It's just the beginning.
Hamjambo watoto wenzangu.
Hatujambo.
Huu ni mwaka wangu wa 16. Niko darasa la 5. Niko naishi na virusi. Na natumia dawa zangu kwa wakati tunaofaa. Na sina shida. Na nitaishi na nitaoa. Nawahimiza yule ambaye anajua yuko na virusi ajitokeza asijifiche kule nyumbani. Kwa hivyo kuishi na virusi sio mwisho wa maisha.
This is my 16th year living with the virus and I am in grade 6. I use my medicine at the prescribed time. I'm well. I will live and get married too. I'm urging those who are living with HIV and AIDS to come out because if one is infected, it's not the end of the life.
Hamjambo watoto wenzangu.
Hamjambo.
Na miaka ya 12. Nilikuwa naomba wazazi wale watoto walio hapo nyumbani ambao wana virusi msiwatenge wala msiwafanye lolote wala msiwafiche. Nilikuwa naomba mjitokeze kupimwa kujua hali zenu wala tukaungane pamoja wala msiwatenge watoto wenye virusi.
Hello my fellow children. I am 12 years old. Dear parents, I'm urging you not to discriminate over children who are HIV positive. Please bring them out so that they can mingle with the others like us. And to the society, please come out and get tested so that you know your HIV status. And please do not discriminate children who are HIV positive.
Kwanza nilifika class 7 ndio nikaona mlongo naanza kutoa rashes nikaenda osi kapima nikaambia kwamba nilizaliwa na virusi vya ukimwi lakini sikufa moyo nilende nikapata advice na daktari akaniambia wewe ukisha kunywa dawa utakuwa sawa dawa zangu nimezaga saa 3 usiku.
When I was in class 7 I noticed that I had rashes over my body. When I went to hospital I was tested and I was told that I was born with HIV. But I was not discouraged. I talked to the doctor and he told me that when you take these medications, you will be okay. Let me show you how I take this medication.
Nafungua dawa na kuonyesha vile nakunywa. Hapa kuna dawa 30 na natumia moja moja asubuhi. Hizi ndo seprin, hasa ikifika saa 3 za usiku na hiyo na seprin moja. Alafu nakunywa. Nikisha kunywa nalala mpaka kesho. Ziko 3. Zikisha ninapata gadeti ya kurudi.
Here, in this bottle, I have 30 tablets that I use, one every morning. And this is Septrin. I take one tablet at 9 p.m. every day. After taking it, I go to bed and sleep. When I'm out of these medicines, I usually go back to hospital and get more.
On Wings, you are listening to a report by Diana Wanyonyi about a community in Kenya dealing with HIV. The UNAIDS theme for 2024 is Let Communities Lead. At a World AIDS Day press conference, they largely credited communities' work with lowering the cost of providing life-saving treatment from as much as $25,000 per person year in 1995 to as low as $70 in 2023. In order to lead, many communities depend on drug supplies from other countries, often the United States. Since the epidemic began, the U.S. has approved nearly 50 HIV drugs. It has not been possible, however, to develop a vaccine. In 2021, the U.S. approved a time-release injectable that lasts for 2 months. Kenya has begun testing that on a small group. Meanwhile, the patients Diana interviewed rely on a strict regimen of pill-taking with whichever drug is made available at the time. Again, here's Diana Wanyonyi interviewing two mothers who volunteer for the community HIV program at a hospital in Kilifi County on Kenya's coast.
Parents and guardians of these children have urged the government to be proactive in training the public on accepting and living in coexistence with people living with HIV, especially along the coastal region of Kenya.
Mimi ni moja kati ya wale ambao wanaishi na virusi vinavyosababisha ukimwi, lakini hata hivyo nashukuru tangu nilipimwa nikajua hali yangu sioni tofauti na mtu ambaye hana virusi.
I am one of the person who is HIV positive. Since I got tested, I don't see any difference between me and a person who is HIV negative.
Mimi mwenyewe niko na watoto 6 lakini kati ya wale watoto 6 mmoja peke yake ndiye anaishi na virusi.
I have 6 children and only one of them lives with the virus. All my children know that me and their brother we are HIV positive.
Kwanza lishe, makazi, vyote ni changamoto kwangu kwa sababu mimi kazi ni volunteer yenyewe ninayofanya.
I am a volunteer at the hospital, so my challenge is food and a decent home. I'm unemployed and yet we don't have enough food. And when I take medicine and we don't have food, it makes me and my son very weak, and other children also suffer. These drugs are very strong. So when my son goes to school on empty stomach, when his teacher phones me to inquire, I tell him my son didn't take food at home. So the teacher decides to buy food for him. I'm requesting non-governmental organizations or government to donate food for us. Also, we are urging independent organizations and government to give us medicine like the previous one, because when we used to take them, we didn't feel dizzy. But these drugs, they are not bad because they elongate our lives. But they are very strong, especially when one takes them on an empty stomach.
Akinwa hizo dawa, akifika shule, kama hakupata lishe nyumbani, akifika shule, huwa inaathiri hata hiyo elimu ya watoto, kwa sababu yule mtoto amemeza dawa, hakupata chakula, amefika shule, anahitajika kusoma, yeye yuasinzia. Sasa pale yakuwa anasinzia, kuna kitu atakachosikiza kweli kutoka kwa mwalimu.
Also at school, these children whose parents are unable to provide food for them, they are unable to concentrate in classes as they feel weak, and it's a must that they need to take drugs.
Hakuna ambacho anakisikiza. Sasa pale inakuwa ni changamoto kwa mzazi na hata kwa mtoto. Manake mtoto ameshindwa kusoma kwa sababu amemeza dawa, na ni lazima amezi, hawezi kosa kumeza.
Nilijifungulia nyumbani, kampeleka mtoto kliniki.
I gave birth and took the baby to the clinic.
Kafikisha mwaka mmoja. Ikiwa bado hajajulikana hali yake. Mtoto akawa ananisumbua sumbua, baada ya hapo ndio alikuja akapimwa, patikana iko HIV positive.
1 year later, the baby started being sickly and we didn't know what was wrong. After she was tested, it emerged that she is HIV positive.
Nilikuwa sina ufahamu, nilipata ufahamu baada ya mtoto kupimwa ya kwamba kuna ugonjwa wa HIV.
I was not aware of HIV/AIDS. I got to know it after my baby's status was revealed.
Tumechukuliwa na hospitali na shirika la NASCOP kwa huduma za peer parents. Tunaelimisha wazazi wenzetu wapate kuleta watoto kuanzia miaka 15 hadi mwaka mmoja kuja kupimwa kujua hali za watoto wao.
We have been contracted by this hospital and National AIDS and STI control program, in short NASCOP, for peer parents program. We have educated and encouraged our fellow parents to bring children between 1 to 15 years to come and get them tested so as to know their health status.
Sababu ni mambo mengi ambao watoto wanapitia kule nyumbani na mashuleni.
This is because children go through a lot at home and in schools.
Kuna kushare vijembe, naweza akapigana mwenye huyu akauma mwenzake, na wote hawajuani hali zao. Pia hiyo inaweza kuambukiza virusi. Tunaendelea kuhamasisha wale wazazi ili wajue kuna mambo kama hayo, wasije wakaona labda ngono peke yake ndiye inasababisha maambukizi ya virusi.
They can share razor blades or they can fight and injure each other. This is important because parents should not rule out that not only sex is the cause of HIV and AIDS.
Tulikaa sisi wazazi tukaona ya kwamba tuliunda support group za watu wazima, lakini watoto wetu tumewaacha nje. Tukaona pia tukiwaacha nje watoto wetu hawatafaidika na lolote wala hawatasaidika.
Through the education we got from our support group, we saw the need of having our group and this children group with the aim of educating them on HIV and AIDS so that when they grow up, they will know what kind of medicine they are taking.
Sababu wengi wetu tunaishi na watoto na hawana mababa, tukaona ya kwamba tena wazazi wengine wanapokaa na watoto kule manyumbani huwa hawaelezei ya kwamba zile dawa wanazotumia ni dawa za nini.
Many children do not have fathers, and some HIV positive parents who live with their children do not tell them the reason they take drugs is because of HIV and AIDS.
kulingana na yale mafundisho ambayo tulikuwa tumeyapata kwa support group zetu, tukaona tuunganishe wale watoto wetu, tuje tu nao pia tuwaelimishe, wakikua wao wanakuwa wakijua madawa wanayotumia ni madawa ya aina gani.
We started with 50 children here and they were getting free food here, but when the food program ended, some of the children stopped coming to Mariakani because of support group only. Some were coming from Mazera and Rabai areas. Many children also do not come because of high transport fare.
Tulianza na watoto 50. Watu walikuwa wanachukua chakula hapa. Lakini tukaendelea, wakati watu walipoanza kutolewa kwa umradi wa chakula, ikawa kwao imekuwa ni changamoto. Hawawezi kuja huku Mariakani kwa sababu ya support group peke yake. Wengine walikuwa wanatoka Mazera, wengine wanatoka Rabai. Sasa wengine sahi waliacha kuja huku sababu ya fare.
On Sundays, when children come here at the hospital, they meet the counselor who educates and guides them through on different ways of fighting stigma and empowering them to speak freely.
Wanakuja hapa Jumapili, wakija huwa saa nyingine huwa tuko na counselors hapa, huwa anawafundisha kuhusu jinsi ya kujiweka wazi.
For girls, the counselor teaches them how to expose men who want to seduce them.
Wasiwe na ile stigma ama kujielezea kinagaubwaga kwamba wao wanaishi na virusi, yani kuwaondoa ile unyanyapaa. Saa nyingine pia anawaelimisha kwamba kama wewe ni msichana, anawaeleza ile skills ambazo kama umetotokozwa na mwanaume, zile njia ambazo za kumfanya yule mwanaume ajulikane ni nani ambaye alikuwa anataka kukufanyia kitendo chochote. Imetusaidia sababu sahihi, hata ukimuuliza msichana sahihi ukitongozwa na mvulana utaanzia wapi, atakuonyesha na anajua ya kwamba sahihi siwezi nikadanganywa na mtu nikakubali akanirepa.
This has helped us a lot because girls are very smart, as they know a man who has intention of seducing and defiling them.
Tuko wengi, lakini kuna wale ambao wamejitolea kama sisi, tunaweza kusimama mbele ya umma, hata mbele ya mabaraza na tukaongea. Lakini kuna wengine hawawezi katika sisi. Sisi tumemasia CHW wa huduma wa nyanjani wa vijijini. Hiyo ndio kazi yetu, kuingia kule nyanjani na kuelimisha kwa wale ambao wanaishi na virusi na wale ambao bado hawajajua hali zao.
We women who are HIV positive are many. Some volunteers like us, we speak publicly about our health status, while others do not have confidence to talk about it.
At a press conference for World AIDS Day, a representative of UNAIDS commended local communities around the world for taking the lion's share of responsibility to intervene in the epidemic. She further noted that the medical infrastructure built to tackle AIDS also helped countries manage COVID. However, she pointed out that contributions to community organizations are declining, and infections have been rising among youth. Again, Diana Wanyonyi in Kenya, this time speaking to a public official.
Head of HIV and AIDS Control Unit in the Ministry of Education, Margaret Mwirigi, says that teachers have responsibility of protecting children in schools despite their health status, adding that they are planning to educate teachers on the importance of keeping confidential information about children living with HIV.
Issues on confidentiality, how to deal with them, counseling and all that, ndio wajue how to handle these children to not to reveal their status.
For these children, their only hope is that the community will embrace them without discriminating and looking down upon them.
We need to implement that policy. We need to implement presidential directives and the ministerial commitments too. The Minister of Education alone cannot achieve. We need to work with the Minister of Health, the community, the parents, faith-based organizations, civil societies, so that we achieve this. And this strategic plan has talked about children living with HIV, or rather vulnerable children. So this program can be rolled to those children. And of course, today, in economy, the economy, you have to work with statistics. And we also need to work in collaboration. Not unless we bring HIV, our the youth to zero, then we are not doing much. Sasa, we require government support so that we fight it.
Completely eradicating HIV among youth is an even more ambitious goal than that adopted by the UN AIDS Agency. Known as 95-95-95, it calls for 95% of all people living with HIV to know their HIV status, 95% of all people with diagnosed HIV infection to receive sustained antiretroviral therapy, and 95% of all people receiving antiretroviral therapy to have viral suppression by 2025. As of July 2023, the following countries, all in Africa, reported having reached that goal. They are Botswana, Rwanda, the United Republic of Tanzania, Zimbabwe, and Eswatini, formerly known as Swaziland. Kenya is not yet on the list.
We know that there is a path to end AIDS.
Anjali Ashrakar is Deputy Director of UNAIDS.
AIDS deaths, for example, have decreased by nearly 70% since they peaked in the early 2000s. There are fewer new infections now than ever before. This is great progress that countries around the world have made. In Nigeria, communities have delivered services in far-reach areas, and we see 64% increase of access to treatment because of communities. In Namibia, youth community organizations have used e-bikes to deliver services to young people who often cannot attend clinics because they're in school. In Ukraine, communities saved people living with HIV. They ensured that through war, life-saving treatment continued. In South Africa, Thailand, and Brazil, it was the community grassroots movements in the 1990s and early 2000s, advocating on the streets, in courts, and in parliaments to ensure life-saving, affordable medicines were available and accessible to all. So communities and countries have been showing the way and leading by example, but the job is not yet done. Every single minute, a life is lost to AIDS. Every week, 4,000 adolescent girls and young women are newly infected by HIV. And still, 9.2 million people around the world that are living with HIV do not have access to life-saving treatment. Communities know how to design, how to implement, how to monitor HIV programs and strategies to reach the people most in need. And it is the communities that will be the ones that sustain the HIV response into the future. But we've seen a decrease in funding around the globe to community organizations. That must increase. And we need to protect everyone's human rights. Right now, anti-human rights, anti-women's rights, anti-democracy, and shrinking civil space has threatened the work of community organizations and communities themselves. This has also threatened the HIV response around the world. We have to remain hopeful and vigilant and continue to defend human rights of the communities that we serve.
Anjali Ashrakar is a UN Undersecretary General and Deputy Executive Director of UNAIDS. She previously worked with PEPFAR, the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. Initiated by former President George W. Bush, the plan had full bipartisan support until 2023, as reported in last week's edition of Wings. Wings thanks our Kenya correspondent, Diana Wanyonyi, for her reporting on youth and mothers' community activities that preserve the lives and dignity of those affected by HIV and AIDS. Thanks also to your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be found at the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. For more about Wings, email wings@wings.org. The Wings Sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frida Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Mark your calendar every last Tuesday of the month and tune in to a special series of Soul Perspectives on 90.3 FM.
Tuesday from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m.
Broadcasting live from West Haven Community Center in NDG.
Tune in to a special series of Soul Perspectives on 90.3 FM.
This Tuesday, January the 30th, we have special guests Zoo 365 Fitness, Sita Gabriel,
and DJ TJ.
Last but not least, West Haven Teens and the After School Program will be blessing us with a special segment.
So, don't forget, tune in every last Tuesday of the month.
Soul Perspective, live from West Haven Community Center. Tune in.
See you then.
This is a West Haven and CQT co-presentation.
Black Theater Workshop presents the world premiere of Diggers by Donna Michelle St. Bernard. Abdul and Solomon introduce newbie Baya to the intricacies and dignity of grave digging. But when illness hits their town, they must make the best of a bad situation. Full of song, laughter, tears, and beautiful humanity, Diggers is a tribute to essential workers. Catch Diggers at the Siegel Center Studio from February 1st to the 17th. Get your tickets at siegelcenter.org or call 514-739-7944. More information at blacktheaterworkshop.ca. This is a Black Theater Workshop and Prairie Theater Exchange co-production and CKUT co-presentation.
Hi, this is Ruby Kato Atwood from Yamantaka Sonic Titan, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Guatsi Halpa, Duhiname Itzakuitsa Shui Mihanu. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm honored to welcome you to the Department of the Interior, which sits on the ancestral homelands of the Anacostan and Piscataway people. Land acknowledgements recognize the Indigenous people who are the original stewards of the lands where we live and work.
That's U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland, the first Native American U.S. Cabinet Secretary. In 2022, she set in motion an investigation into the history of federal, quote, boarding schools that were used to strip away Native cultures from Indigenous children during both the 19th and the 20th centuries.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Again, U.S. Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland.
I come from ancestors who endured the horrors of the Indian boarding school assimilation policies carried out by the same department that I now lead. This department was responsible for operating what we now know to be 408 federal boarding schools across 37 states, or then territories, including 21 schools in Alaska and 7 schools in Hawaii. Now we are uniquely positioned to assist in the effort to recover the dark history of these institutions that have haunted our families for too long.
Haaland is a member of the Pueblo of Laguna. The ancestral territory of her people includes the southwest corner of the state of Colorado. Colorado lawmakers voted funds in 2022 for a year of research into the so-called boarding schools in their state. The state historical agency, History Colorado, released the results in October 2023. Shannon Young reports.
Come here.
A tour guide brings a group of teachers and students through a museum exhibit that blends futuristic multimedia art with ancient Puebloan pottery and a lesson about a 17th century indigenous uprising.
It is very abstract. But I have had fourth graders be like, oh, that reminds me of Wakanda. And I'm like, great, you know exactly what we're trying to do here. You totally get this idea of like,
the exhibit is part of a new, more consultative approach by Colorado State History Institute to bring overlooked and suppressed history into public view. That includes digging into histories of violent displacements and forced assimilations targeting indigenous populations. Holly Norton is Colorado's state archaeologist. She led the year-long investigation into federal Indian boarding schools in Colorado, operating between 1880 and 1920.
Schools in the United States for Native youth and Native people in general have existed since colonial times. Education has always been a facet of that colonial project of assimilation and attempting to conquer this continent. By 1880, what we call the Indian Wars are essentially over. And most, if not every, tribe in the United States has been removed to a reservation. So by the 1880s, schools are starting here in Colorado. A couple of thousand children went through these institutions over this 40-year period. We also had to refine how many schools there were. We ultimately identified 9 institutions that were federally supported, 2 that were off-reservation boarding schools, the way that people typically think of them when they imagine these schools. Fort Lewis Indian Boarding School had approximately 1,100 children, and the Grand Junction Indian School, which was also known as the Teller Institute, had approximately 600 students enrolled during its existence.
There were a handful of lesser schools in what is now the Denver metro area. Some were reform schools. Another was an institution for the deaf and blind, where at least 4 Indigenous students ended up after losing their eyesight or hearing as a result of trachoma, a bacterial infection contracted at boarding schools. State archaeologist Holly Norton says the 1920 cutoff date was chosen for a couple of reasons.
First and foremost, as we were getting into the research, there was so much documentation and the history was so complicated, and we did have that condensed timeline that I made the executive decision as the lead of this project that we had to have a cutoff date so that we could have a substantive product at the end of this legislation. When that decision was made, the hope in the conversation was that this is not finished, right? That this is something that we can come back to. 1920 is a good cutoff date for a couple of reasons. Beginning in the 20s, we start to see some changes in federal Indian policy that affected federal Indian education. And then the second reason why 1920 is a really good cutoff is the primary question going into the research was trying to identify students. Speaking with archival experts, such as the archivists at the National Archives in D.C., our own archivist here at History Colorado, 1920 is often seen as a privacy cutoff date, and beyond that, we can potentially get into living or really recent individuals' private history that could be harmful or painful. And so when we do this research beyond 1920, we need to approach it very sensitively, very carefully, and mindfully of those privacy concerns so that we're not reharming any of the families who've endured these boarding schools for the last century.
Many families of boarding school alumni are the ones at the forefront of pushing for the truth to come out. Among them is attorney Geraldine DeCoto, enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Chippewa. Both of her parents attended boarding schools from an early age. She says the Colorado investigation is a good start, but more work is needed.
I think it's really well done. I think it's sensitively done, it's thorough, it encourages further exploration of particular issues that are really quite important. And mostly what I was impressed with was that there was a decision made not to do the oral histories, the oral interviews, out of consideration for all the considerations around oral histories, you know, what they mean to the boarding school survivors and their descendants, the families, the communities, and how that needs to be handled with some sensitivity before just assuming that, you know, the state should have all those stories for, you know, whatever reason, for progeny, for their collections. And I'm amazed at the way they put all the information together and really seem to have a grasp of what they don't know, what they don't have information about.
The legislation that prompted and funded the Colorado boarding school investigation did originally include a directive to gather oral histories, but the lead researcher argued the one-year timeline was too tight to carry out the work in a sensitive and consultative way. Instead, the team had to rely on other methods like official school correspondence, periodical research, ledgers, and other archives.
I wasn't surprised to find that they don't have much information and that they had to piece this information together from crazy sources like newspaper articles rather than official reports. There was such a lack of any kind of organized reporting or feedback that it was almost just up to individual schools to say what they wanted to say, usually in narrative style reports, which I've read quite a few of those kinds of documents, and they are interesting. And you would think because they're narrative style that they might contain some information that was more informative about the way the kids' lives were in school, but it almost like information that could be put on a chart or a spreadsheet or something. Like we talked about how many potatoes the kids ate rather than how they felt about having their hair cut off, probably before they could even speak a word of English to say anything about it.
Geraldine DeCoto knows well how little information is out there regarding the true extent of the Native American boarding school experience. More than a decade ago, she co-founded the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition.
Yeah, I mean, I was aware that my parents went to boarding school, although they didn't really talk about it, really didn't know much about their stories. My mother died when she was 47, so I didn't really get to talk to her very much about her boarding school experience before she died. My dad lived much longer, so we were able to talk to him a little bit and gain some other understanding. But the boarding school issue really became accessible to me, I think, when we had a symposium in Boulder coordinated by the Native American Rights Fund and the University of Colorado on boarding schools in the United States and boarding school healing. And we invited some of the Canadian commissioners who had conducted the boarding school research up there, Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And they were just at the end of that process and might have even been before they published their 94, whatever that number was, findings and recommendations. But they came and we created the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. And I was a founding board member and then served as the president for, I think, about 6 years, and then I was termed out. And by that time, there was enough interest generated that we were getting more board members and more young people, which was a good thing. Anyways, that is where I prepared my first boarding school presentations. And of course, it's morphed. There's several generations of what I talk to people about now, but I've been sharing the history of boarding schools and my own family's history for many, many years now. And I do enjoy doing that, although it's not easy to do. So forming the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, I think, was absolutely critical to getting the broader story told, to getting the national attention. There are lots of things that aided that, like I said, the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and of course, Deb Haaland becoming the Secretary of the Interior in the discovery of those 215 bodies at Kamloops in British Columbia. All of these things lit a fire in the consciousness of people, I think, in the United States. There's so much now. There's so many films. There's so many books. There's so many opportunities to learn.
You are listening to Wings, the Women's International News Gathering Service. I'm Shannon Young. Today, we're looking at the state of Colorado's investigation into so-called federal Indian boarding schools from 1880 to 1920. The one-year investigation was the result of a state law passed in 2022. We're hearing from Colorado State Archaeologist Dr. Holly Norton, who led the investigation, as well as Geraldine Decoto, co-founder of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. By the 1880s, the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes had already been forced off their traditional lands in Colorado into reservations in Wyoming and in Oklahoma. The Southern Ute and Ute Mountain Ute tribes continued to reside in portions of ancestral lands in southwestern and western Colorado, respectively. State archaeologist Holly Norton says Colorado's largest boarding schools were intended for Ute children, but their parents resisted sending their children in large numbers.
I think what was less understood, at least by, you know, white academics like myself, I think this was probably more understood by my Ute colleagues, is the level of resistance that the Ute had to these schools in 1880, 1890, into the 20th century. The Ute really stood steadfast, keeping their children out of school or pulling them out whenever there was the first indication that something was not going well in these schools or that their kids were in danger or in harm's way.
Colorado's state-level investigation into the federal system of Native American boarding schools found that 31 students died at the Fort Lewis School, and another 37 individuals died at the Grand Junction School. This information came from archival research, but the team also conducted studies using non-invasive ground-penetrating radar. Norton says that before determining how to move forward with the investigation, she looked closely at work already underway in both the U.S. and in Canada.
Canada has really been at the forefront in some ways, and there is some really good both published and unpublished best practices that have come out, especially for geophysical work. Another investigation that's actually still currently ongoing that I looked closely at and that I talked to colleagues is the Tulsa Race Massacre investigations.
The Tulsa Race Massacre occurred in the state of Oklahoma in 1921. Over the span of 2 days, white mobs rampaged through the city's Greenwood District, nicknamed Black Wall Street. The assailants killed around 300 black residents and burned down more than 35 city blocks. It's another suppressed chapter of U.S. history that is coming to light more than a century later. Colorado State archaeologist Holly Norton says she hopes her team's methodology for archival research has added to the suite of tools.
There was already some best practices for geophysical work laid out by my Canadian colleagues. One of the things that I've tried to elucidate to complement that is the complexities of archival research. I think still today, a lot of people think you can just walk into the National Archives and there's the big book of boarding schools and all of your questions are answered. Archival work is super complex, right? It's much more complex than that. That's why we rely on archivists. They're experts and they're our colleagues in helping us not only find the information, but also helping us to translate it. Like, what is this type of document? What does it mean? Why do we have this document and not this other document? How do things get stored? And all of these are really important questions that you have to understand and that you have to answer before you can say, I have this information and this is what it's telling me. So I don't know if I succeeded, but I was really hoping to kind of lay out the strengths and weaknesses of archival research in the report so that the general public would understand. You know, if someone is trying to understand their grandmother's experience at one of these schools and they don't understand why they can't find them in a document or that this document says X, Y, and Z, I'm hoping that my report can give them some insight into how those documents were created.
One of the historical records providing insight into a pattern of abuse was a series of investigative reports published in 1903 by the Denver Post. The series focused on allegations against Thomas Breen, who was the superintendent of the Fort Lewis School for nearly a decade. While Breen never faced charges, the Denver Post detailed multiple allegations of sexual and physical abuse targeting women and girls at the school, as well as neglect, starvation, unsanitary conditions, and embezzlement of funds. Another practice the History Colorado researchers were able to document using historical records was that of the so-called outing program.
It was framed as an apprenticeship, but I think that that's too soft of an idea. Once children were in these industrial and agricultural schools for a few years and they learned a set of skills, then they were sent off to live with white families. Girls and women were sent to live as domestics, and so they would cook and clean and do childcare for families, ostensibly for a wage. We know, at least in Colorado, sometimes those wages were withheld from students and they never saw them. Boys and men were sent to work in fields to do heavy agricultural labor back east, where the schools were more industrial and factory focused. Then they would be sent to apprentice in various industries. But in almost every case, all of these jobs were incredibly difficult labor. They were the lowest rung of the socioeconomic ladder. And that was the extent of the expectations for these children. They were not trained to be doctors or nurses or teachers.
Norton says her big takeaway from the year-long investigation into the history of federal Indian boarding schools in Colorado is how they were just one piece of a larger set of interlocking policies.
I think what really struck me in this research was how insidious federal Indian policy was in the late 19th, the early 20th century. And I'm sure that there are plenty of scholars who know a lot more than I do who would say through the 20th century and into today. We often think of these boarding schools or these other historical Native policies in these compartmentalized way, but they were all related. And the different ways that the federal government, that state governments, that local community members just really abused, oppressed, stole from our Native community was embedded in our legal system. All of these things are related, and just seeing these kind of tendrils of assimilation and oppression through all of these different sorts of policies that were ultimately related is something that has really struck me, and I think that is important for us to think about as we move forward and we talk about reconciliation. What are we reconciling? How are we reconciling these past grievances and atrocities? And what does it mean to find ways to support our Native communities and build back healthier relationships between state and tribal governments?
Those are questions Turtle Mountain Chippewa attorney Geraldine Dakota has spent many years pondering and working to answer through involvement in numerous organizations.
I really do feel like awareness is changing, the truth is being told, the stories are being shared, and I don't know that we're there yet as far as healing, but we're getting there. And I know that one of the recent things, and I don't know how much money it was, a couple million dollars or something, that's being devoted to gathering oral histories. I think that will be done well and correctly. Now the National Native and Boarding School Healing Coalition was, I think, awarded that money to do this. So I think that they will do a careful job, a sensitive job. There will be, you know, emotional, psychological support for the people who are willing to participate in that kind of an effort. But that will be another chapter in learning about the boarding school history. And I think then some healing can come. Personally, what I think is probably the most important thing to help with healing is language revitalization, teaching young people the language. In one generation, in my family, my mother and father were both fluent Ojibwe and Cree speakers, and none of us of their kids has any fluency at all beyond a word or two. I mean, that's one generation gone. But I think the exciting thing that's happening is that younger people are learning the language in more formal settings and also with elders, and they're teaching kind of this couple of generations that got sandwiched in between, or we didn't learn our language. So my daughter is a teacher at Ojibwa school, K through 8, and she is going to get certified at our tribal college to teach Ojibwe. And there is a whole cohort of teachers that they're offering this to. And they're going to teach the kids. And I really think that that's going to help us reconnect with our cultures in the most meaningful way. I really do. Language is that critical. But that being said, each tribe, each individual, for survivor and each tribal community has to decide for itself how it wants to pursue healing.
Shortly after releasing the findings of the year-long investigation, Colorado State archaeologist Holly Norton says she hopes they serve as a basis for further research into the issue and a better understanding of state history.
Now that this portion of the report is finished, I think that we need to have more conversations and consultations with community. So what we'd like to do in the near future and moving forward is have consultations, both the government-to-government tribal consultations, as well as community conversations with communities who are descendants of or impacted by this history. And I think that future steps are going to have to come from those communities. What are their needs and wants and desires for work moving forward? And that might be the oral history scope of work that we have ready to try to implement. That might be more research from 1920 on. That might be more research into some of these questions like you've asked me today. But I think we're prepared to kind of sit back a little bit and hear that from communities before rushing forward and making these decisions ourselves.
Recovery and restoration of what was lost or taken requires knowledge, be that of a native language or of traditional practices. Legal expert Geralyn Dakota, who is now a grandmother, says she does feel progress is being made in the right direction. And a lot of it has to do with how suppressed history is becoming common knowledge.
I feel like there's a shift after all these years of doing this with the community. I feel like there's progress, and I feel like we have a language. So when we say things like boarding schools and intergenerational trauma, taking of land, illegal removal of tribes, people understand what we're talking about.
For the Women's International News Gathering Service, I'm Shannon Young in Boulder, Colorado.
While the Colorado researchers did not feel prepared to collect oral histories during their one-year time frame, U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland has expressed commitment to that next step.
As a Pueblo woman, it is my responsibility, and frankly, it's my legacy. As part of the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative and in response to recommendations from the report, I will travel across the country to use my platform to elevate American Indian, Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian survivors of the Federal Indian Boarding School system and give them the opportunity to share their stories, help connect communities with trauma-informed support, and facilitate the collection of a permanent oral history. This is one step among many that we will take.
Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Every day of my life.